we're ready to go. Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
Okay, thanks for your patience.
And I apologize.
We're ready to go, and Dr. Galbraith said he would take questions on the fly.
Yeah, sure. Feel free to interrupt. This is a presentation which is rather out of character for me normally. I generally restrict myself to empirical investigations into various topics. But after a long career here of teaching on various economic themes, I became motivated to prepare a book on what I really think. And so this is the fruit of that effort, and it's a book published by the University of Chicago Press in January of last year and co-authored with a mathematician that I have been working with on and off for 15 or 17 years, who teaches finance at the University of Northern British Columbia. And we published, as you can see here, a number of articles in various obscure academic journals. And this is a book which is based primarily on a couple of those articles which appeared in 23 and 24 in the Review of Evolutionary Political Economy, with a great deal of exposition built around that structure. It takes a certain amount of gumption, I think, to tackle the question of what is a theory of value in economics. And so I want to say a few words about that. These are obviously foundational issues, and they're issues which have receded from view, certainly over the last half century or so. I think when I was in graduate school, they were still pretty current, but I don't think that's the case anymore. Foundations tend to be covered up, and they tend to become visible only when they are vulnerable and start to crumble. And they start to crumble when they've been neglected for a long period of time. So for that reason, I would argue it is appropriate to take a look at them now. And this concept, obviously, is entirely in line with the basic notion of entropy. What were the major themes and the major trends or tendencies in theories of value? If one starts with classical political economy, running roughly from Adam Smith, David Ricardo, Karl Marx, John Stuart Mill, there was a body of thought which based value on the quantity of labor which was embodied in the production of commodities, what Marx called socially necessary labor time. This was a theory which was largely, I wouldn't say restricted, but focused on goods that could be produced and reproduced. In other words, it was a theory that was well suited to the emerging problems of the Industrial Revolution and to the scientific interest that really developed with the French Revolution in the matter of an invariable standard of value. So it is in some sense comparable to the creation of the metric system and the existence of an invariable meter in some cavern in Paris at constant temperatures. And this was a theory which, by the late part of the last third of the 19th century, was largely considered to be accepted, and Mill declared it to be complete, at which point it promptly collapsed and was superseded by another body of thought which came into economics from emerging tendencies in physics at that particular time, associated with William Stanley Jevons and Alfred Marshall, and coming down to us through such figures as Paul Samuelson. A theory of value which shifted the entire basis of fundamental economics from the process of production to the process of consumption and to the psychological satisfactions associated with market processes. And this was a theory which dealt, as became quite explicit in the exposition of it by Arrow and De Bruyn in the early 1950s, with goods that exist, with goods that are allocated, with scarce resources trying to find their best uses, and the value is to be achieved essentially in equilibrium. Arrow and De Bruyn put put this theory into an extremely advanced form such that the mathematical economist E. Roy Weintraub declared that it was a very well-arranged cemetery with beautiful tombstones. And so put the whole thing fundamentally in the same position that Mill had put the labor theory of value. But not much has happened since then. The arrow de birth theory exists today largely in a kind of negative limbo in which it is often defended as stating conditions for the existence and stability of a competitive equilibrium, and with the acknowledgement that those conditions don't exist in the real world and can't exist in the real world because, among other things, they involve the existence of essentially an unlimited number of perfect futures markets, which is inconsistent with the existence of calendar time. But it remains largely the underpinning, if you like, or the psychological justification for the most ordinary forms of supply and demand analysis, competitive market, of prices and quantities, and equilibrium. And in this representation, the concept of value is largely lost as a distinct phenomenon from the market price, or at least the market price that would be achieved under all of those strenuous conditions of rationality, perfect competition, perfect information, and so on and so forth. Already in the 1920s, this is a formulation which is owed to Marshall and is certainly elaborated by Samuelson and all of his successors in the economics textbook literature. Already in the 1920s, Pierre Sraffa, who I got to know a little bit toward the end of his life at Cambridge in the 1970s, was saying that that was fundamentally unsatisfactory as the basis, but it nevertheless has persisted and still forms the foundation of elementary instruction in the subject. Keynes had something to say on the subject, but what he had to say is sometimes a little bit hard to discern. My favorite characterization or summary of Keynes's position on value theory comes from chapter 2 of the general theory, in which he said famously that the classical theorists, by which he meant the neoclassicals, resemble Euclidean geometers in a non-Euclidean world who discover that inexperienced straight lines apparently parallel often meet, rebuke the lines for not keeping straight as the only remedy for the unfortunate collisions which are occurring. Yet in truth, there is no remedy except to throw over the axiom of parallels and to work out a non-Euclidean geometry. And that passage occurs in the context of his attack on the supply curve in economics, essentially, which is the same problem that Sraffa was raising in the 1920s. Keynes, in saying this, is drawing in a very straightforward way on this figure over here, Albert Einstein, and on Riemannian geometry, which is the foundation of relativity. And I have argued in a paper a long time ago that the general theory, Keynes's title itself, is a direct appeal to Einstein's general theory, special general theory of relativity. And in fact, there is plenty of evidence that that is the case, including an essay by Keynes on Einstein. So these two drawings are by the same cartoonist. This one, Keynes in his armchair, is one that I happen to own an original copy of. So anyway, very famous drawing. What was Keynes's theory of value? I think that it's possible to interpret Keynes as essentially taking a philosophical perspective drawn from his own background as a student of Russell and G.E. Moore, that he was seeking a world in which value was to be found in beauty or truth, not necessarily in any specific economic conditions, but in the larger social conditions that he was trying to create and preserve. This, however, is not the way what became Keynesian economics has evolved, certainly in its American formation, and the applications of Keynesian economics to the management of the Second World War and then to the problem of growth afterwards, has basically created a world in which a Keynesian economics is associated with an implicit notion that value is essentially gross domestic product, the total volume of goods and services that are being purchased and sold and created in the economy, which is a bit of a cop-out because it essentially abandons, in the neoclassical synthesis, the valuation of individual goods and services to the market price. Philosophical terms is also psychological terms, which is why the caricature of Freud appears here. This is not a question which has absolutely died out. And in the last few days, I've been reading the advanced text of a book which will appear this year, which was being prepared posthumously on behalf of Luigi Pezzanetti by his son. And it's a rather, it's an exceedingly beautiful book called The Labor Theory of Value, in which Pezzanetti is bringing to bear an entire lifetime of reflection on the progression from Marx to Schraffa and to his own work. And if you're familiar with this rather extraordinary figure, you can see that something that he took very seriously at the end of his life, and the book itself runs well over 500 pages, so it's quite an accomplishment for a person who was well into his 90s when he passed away in 2023. All right. Our thought, which is not original with us, is that we can usefully contribute to this discussion by bringing the second law of thermodynamics, the entropy law, to bear on the question of economic value, and on the problem of production as well. The entropy law, as I'm sure you know, is the proposition that heat always moves away from the hotter body. Disorder has a tendency to increase. Entropy captures that tendency, and it was expressed as the foundation of information theory by Claude Shannon in 1948, so underpinning of modern computer science as well. This is a product. Entropy in thermodynamics is a product of the late 19th century. The understanding of it is, and I couldn't resist including a slide of a particular scientific endeavor which condemned the world to the measurement of the calorie content of food, as well as discovering, for those of you who like to imbibe, that alcohol in fact has food value. This is associated with what we would now call a biochemist at Wesleyan University in Connecticut named Wilbur Olman Atwater, who also happens to be my maternal great-grandfather. So inherited affection for him. He died in 1908. This is where he is now, in the Indian Hill Cemetery in Middletown, Connecticut. How can entropy be applied to economic thinking? Well, we understand the entropy law to be the most basic law of nature, but it doesn't appear to have an effect on textbook understanding of economic processes, because such processes are centered on the concept of equilibrium. And once an equilibrium is achieved, the nature of equilibrium is it has no tendency to change unless something hits it from the outside, which gives you a subject that has considerable difficulty dealing with the ordinary processes of life and society, in which things do tend to change and to decay and to break down. And as a result, to take one famous example, when the financial system experiences a massive crisis, economists tend to have nothing to say about it. We're shocked from the outside. No one could have foreseen it. That's in the nature of the thought processes to which they have become habituated. And that's just one of many instances which makes it at least an arguable case for trying to incorporate concepts like entropy into economics. Paul Samuelson was exceedingly and vocally opposed to this, and we quote him in our book saying, there's really nothing more pathetic than to have an economist or a retired engineer try to force analogies between the concepts of physics and the concepts of economics. How many dreary papers have I had to referee in which the author is looking for something that corresponds to entropy or to one another form of energy? And in the very next paragraph, he falls victim to the same temptation and draws an analogy between entropy and the wage rate, that same relationship of the wage rate to labor and the land rent to acreage. Philip Murawski had a rather arch comment on this about Samuelson's general tendency to make reference to physics without taking account of the actual content of physical theory for what he was talking about. But in any event, Samuelson was clearly aware that there was a danger to the structures of theory that he had articulated in the foundations of economic analysis that came from the entropy law. We're not the first to point this out. 1971, Nicholas Georgescu Regan wrote an important book called The Entropy Law of the Economic Process. And he really stopped a bit short, but because he became convinced, or at least he could not work out, how one could usefully apply the entropy law to the determination of prices and values and prices. And this is the problem that we took on. Or I should say that my co-author took on and persuaded me was an exceedingly interesting thing to do. And so he developed, and I articulate for you, an entropy theory of value. It is based upon two very simple and straightforward variables. One of them is what we call a probability or a measure of scarcity of an economic product. And what I think needs to be understood here is that by a good or a service, we mean something quite specific. We mean a particular item that is brought to market by a producer with a particular set of characteristics, very much in the spirit that E.H. Chamberlain wrote about in the 1930s in a book called Toward a More General Theory of Value. Not so much a generic commodity, but the specific things that you go out and buy, which are presented to you as having distinct characteristics practically from anything else that's on the market. So the probability is the degree of scarcity, the degree of market penetration. And the proposition is that when this is a number from 0 to 1, the negative log is a positive number, and as that number increases, as a product enters the market and then expands to cover, become more prevalent, its economic value is going to decline. And the other thing is the choice of the base for the log function. Shannon, in his information theory, chose a base of 2, 0, 1, because computer code is basically expressed in 0-1 terms. Our thought is that the base can usefully be reflect the number of suppliers. That is to say, the degree of monopoly or oligopoly in the market. And you take those two things together, and you get a value equation of extreme simplicity. If you take multiple processes and you average them, you get this expression, which is essentially isomorphic to the entropy expression in Shannon's theory. Yeah?
Could you explain how it goes with extremes?
Say what?
Could you explain intuitively how it goes in the extremes? So, for example, if it is a monopoly or if it is a complicated.
Yeah, I'll show you just a second. Yeah. I mean, you can put the numbers into the equation, and this is what you get. Scarcity. As scarcity decreases, as the probability increases, the value is going to decline. So you've got a very straightforward, specific relationship. And similarly, market power actually declines very quickly as the base goes up from, well, you can't really have a base of 1, but from something close to 1. And the implication is there really is no such thing as a completely perfect monopoly, as that would imply unlimited power. So such things, if they threaten, will always be regulated in some way and kept from exercising the full power that they would have. But the valuations will tend to decline as the number of suppliers increases. Okay, so that's the mathematics behind the theory of value as we express it. There, I think, could be hard to come up with something simpler. When I get to production, it will be considerably more complicated. But it has a number of very specific implications which we're thinking about. One of them is that it calls attention to the very important role of resources in economic activity. When they are abundant, they have low value, but they form the foundation of activities which can be derivative activities which can be presented to the market as being scarce through the exercise of some monopoly power, so they generate economic value. Food, energy, rare earths are all examples. Energy and rare earths feed a system that generates new technologies. Food, of course, feeds an entire society, which is why agricultural products are typically subsidized and available at low prices. So again, they feed into processes which generate products that have economic value. And the control of resource-producing regions is key to the wealth of regions that don't have such resources. That's not a deep insight, but one which is entirely consonant with the theory. The example of critical minerals has been much in the news, and I particularly call your attention to the case of gallium, which is not itself a rare earth, but a byproduct of the refining of bauxite into alumina, first stage in aluminum production. And this is an industry in which the U.S. had a significant presence as late as 1980, but it's been declining ever since. And the current situation is one in which the Chinese advantage is about 90 million metric tons per year to 1 million metric tons per year, which helps to explain the authority that the Chinese have been exercising in the trade negotiations with the United States. And I think helps to very much to explain why, after an exceedingly tense start through the relationship between China and the second Trump administration, a truce was achieved. And in fact, if you may have noticed, if you subjected yourself to the President's State of the Union, the word China did not appear in the course of a two-hour speech for the first time in 20 years of States of the Union. So that, I think, tells you something about the state of play in that particular situation. Russian gas and oil is another example, which I think stands out in the recent applications. The sanctions on Russian gas and also the destruction of the Nord Stream pipelines were predicated on the idea that Russia needed funds in order to fight the war. But if you look at it in material terms, what it did was to reserve those resources for Russian use, where prices remained stable in spite of the breakout of the war, whereas in Europe they went up to the point where the Europeans now have to buy their natural gas at about three times the price, and the consequences for the profitability of European industry are very clear. I have made that case that in a separate paper that sanctions in many forms, including especially this one, were a gift to the Russian Federation from the Biden administration. Not an intentional one, but based upon the misapplication of neoclassical production theory to this problem, and I'll come to that. The armaments trade is another example. And we would argue that Western armament suppliers tend to have diversified products which they like to sell to multiple customers, and that gives them the market power. Whereas in the countries on the other side of the divide, of the conflicts that are currently going on, Russia notably, but also China, the producers are selling to one government, and it is the government rather than the producers that have the, have the market power, with the result that there's an enormous difference in the price, unit price, of essential armaments such as artillery shells, which explains why, with much less money, the Russian government can produce, outproduce the entire North Atlantic alliance. Here's an example, numerical example, of the case of market integration, which I apply to the example of the United States and Venezuela. And you can calculate this out from the expression I gave you, of market size of different market sizes, different levels of scarcity, a resource poor region, value of 0.2, resource rich region flooded with oil, a unit price that's therefore much higher in the resource poor region than in the resource rich region. Anybody who knows what it was like in Venezuela knows that, that gasoline was being sold at a very competitive price. And you can calculate the total value of the product in when the two markets are segregated, and you bring them together, which has since more or less happened, and the whole value is going to fall, but it's going to fall much more in the resource poor region. It's going to rise in the resource rich region. With the result that you can say that resource producers in the resource rich region and the consumers in the resource poor region would tend to benefit from integration. Producers get a higher price, the consumers get a lower one, but consumers in the resource rich region, that is to say the Venezuelan consumers and producers in the resource poor region, will be unhappy unless, of course, it's the producers in the resource poor region who take control of the resources in the resource rich region, as you can see. But the simple table, which is calculated out of the expression that I just gave you, gives you a set of definite predictions. Not only predictions as to the general direction, but really, if you put down precise numbers, if you can get them, quite precise predictions of what is likely to happen to the relative market valuations. And that's it. That's the first part of the presentation dealing with the theory of value. As I say, it's an analytical theory. You can plug in numbers, derive predictions. And it's a non-equilibrium theory. And this is very important, because this probability is always increasing, generally always increasing. It may decrease provisionally if two markets are brought together and you suddenly have a larger market space in which a given good is scarcer, which is why producers of monopoly goods like to have big markets. Right? But generally speaking, over time, any commodity penetrates a market, saturates, and its economic value will decline over time. The only equilibrium, if you like, if you want to insist on an equilibrium, is the maximum entropy, and that's when the product no longer has any economic value, at which point it will no longer be produced. Okay. Let me move on to the mathematically more intricate exposition of the theory of production. And I'll say a word about classical or textbook theory, which is, and has again its two variations of the classical political economy, basically about the application of labor to land and raw materials, creation of net product or surplus value. That's Quesnay, roughly through Marx. The neoclassical theory of production reformulates the production problem as a case of the combination of factors in factor markets. So we talk about labor markets and capital markets and maybe financial markets. Nothing really changes in the production process. Things are combined. It's like the making of a salad, if you like. There is no irreversible change. And the main point of the theory is an analysis of the returns to factors. So you can see this in the familiar form of Cobb-Douglas production function, which we're all familiar with, in which technological change, capital, labor, and a technology coefficient. And you can calculate out the values of the Cobb-Douglas production function. I don't know if you've ever seen such a table, but it shows you that if you had a complete choice of the technologies, you would choose either to be all labor or all capital, because that's where you would have the highest level of output. In a competitive market, that's what you would do. And if you're stuck in a particular technology, the choice of capital labor ratio is given to you by the maximum that you can achieve. So it's already fixed. It's not the flexible substitution theory that it purports to be. And I won't waste a lot of time on it, except to say it really is a very unsatisfactory picture of production process. Yeah, go ahead, sorry.
Going back from the previous one, so the assumption is going to be, in your case, the assumption is going to be, I have this amount of capital, I have this amount of labor, what can I do?
That's what Cognizant is telling you, yes. Right? You have a certain technology, and you choose the capital labor ratio, right?
But to maximize the output.
To maximize the output.
Exactly. In your case, you're saying, we cannot, I mean, it's not clear that we're going to be able to maximize the output. This is what I have in terms of labor and capital.
Well, I'm just saying that it's not a terribly useful way to think about a whole range of problems.
Okay.
Because the parameters are capital, labor, and technology. So what is it? What's missing here? Resources are just not present in the story. They're completely absent. The aging of social structures, infrastructure, all these stresses, the things that happen through time. Now, once you have the capital, labor, and the technology, you're basically, it's a determined process. It tends to work to justify existing distributions, so that was part of the purpose of creating it in the 1920s, to deflate the Marxist analysis of surplus value. Because of the importance of the solo residual, it tends to support heavy support to innovators, to people who can advance that A parameter. And that is why we have, well, you can say if you want to attribute persuasive power to economic theory, it's why we have people like Elon Musk, who has capital value depends heavily on support. And it cannot explain decline. There's a steady progress implicit in the theory. Okay. What do we think should be alternative principles for a production theory? First of all, that all organized activity is based on prior investment. Whether if you're a leaf and you want to use sunlight for photosynthesis, you need to have a cell and chlorophyll has been created. If you're an animal, you need to have a whole system to take resources from the environment and process them. And the same is true at the economic and social levels. Investment and investment in larger social structures. So all of these organizations have boundaries. It's true of cells, it's true of firms, it's true of countries, it's true of any kind of organism. And they're all built according to plans. We are constructed out of DNA, machines are constructed out of blueprints, and societies are constructed out of habits, laws, and regulations. We accept, because it's obvious that you have to, it's Carnot's principle, that there have to be inequalities. Inequalities are what motivate all forms of work. It's true of differentials of heat, of pressure, of income, and of wealth. But inequalities are dangerous. If they're too large, your blood pressure will cause you serious health difficulties. Your car engine will tend to break down. Your reactor might suffer a meltdown. And your society will be subject to various instabilities. And I wrote a book which prefigured this called Inequality and Instability some years ago. But this is the point. Inequalities are essential, but they're dangerous. And that's built into the theory. And therefore, everything is regulated. Everything has to be regulated. Markets cannot exist without governments that provide limits on their activity. And those limits are all, is in some sense, about controlling inequalities. And that's true whether you're talking about inequality of income, but it's also true about environmental conditions and occupational safety. This is all about avoiding extreme conditions, which are inequalities. So you can think about these things as having sort of an isomorphic intellectual structure. All right. I should say in passing that the same general principles can be used to measure inequalities, and that's a project that I've been involved in for many, many years. But essentially, these are entropy-based measures of inequality. And they're very effective, and they're very, you know, they have a lot of, I would say, plausibility compared to other ways of approaching the measurement of inequalities. But I'm not into that. Entropy theory of production. We argue, contrary to the standard view, that production and not exchange is the first and foremost activity. That you don't have, if you don't have anything produced, you don't have anything to exchange. And so beginning with exchange and treating everything as being derivative of exchange is a conceptual error. That all production requires resources which are of low entropy or high quality, and those have to be extracted with a usable surplus. Otherwise, nothing's going to happen. You're not going to be able to get anything. To do that, you have to have made a fixed investment according to a plan. All complex systems, I should say, tend to be more efficient. So we build up productive systems so as to improve our capacity to take resources from the environment and with a surplus. But again, another important caveat: the more complex a system it is, the more fragile it is, the greater danger associated with a breakdown. And again, there's no equilibrium in real life except when the whole system goes down and breaks down. Nothing lasts forever. So one has to be aware. Yeah.
But what is maintained in your case?
What
is maintenance means in your case? What are you thinking of?
In any system, you have to try to keep it. If it's a functioning system, you have to try to keep it going as long as possible. Uh-huh. Right. So again, in my case, that means I take my blood pressure medicines because I am an old man, and I keep my car with oil and water and other things that are necessary, air in the tires. And I continually tinker with the structures of society, which is what a legislature and a government are going to do. But I say these things are basically walls should be thought of as having a similar process. Okay. Those are principles. Then the question is, can you express them in mathematical form? And the answer to that is, well, yeah, you can actually, and it's quite similar to finance theory, to the Black-Scholes formula, with a difference of sign. And the Black-Scholes is a backward-looking thermodynamic equation, and ours is forward-looking, and it can be expressed here. I'm not going to go into it in detail, but fundamentally, this equation gives you an expression for variable cost as a function a product value, fixed cost, uncertainty, and the duration of the product, and for the rate of discount. Put those things in, and you can calculate out the relationships between these variables. And that's much easier for me to express than it is to go through this rather abstruse bit of mathematics, but here are some implications of it. First one is that if you have a low uncertainty environment, then you are favoring investments which have high fixed costs. Very straightforward. When China decided to build the Three Gorges Dam in the 1990s, it was because uncertainty for the larger environment had dropped dramatically with the collapse of the Soviet Union, and they were not so worried that they were going to be attacked. So they could undertake a big project with a considerable amount of strategic danger, but that nevertheless at the time was going to increase the electricity supply in the country by 10%, which it did. Okay. However, as I think that's good on that. Let's go on. Secondly, you put the rate of return on this axis, the volume of output on this axis, and look at low fixed cost investments as compared to high fixed cost investments. What emerges is that the break-even point with high fixed costs is higher, you need more volume. The rate of return as you go up, this goes up more rapidly. So this is the difference between building a small or a large-scale enterprise. You have to get more output out of the large-scale one, but the rate of return rises more rapidly. with help. Here's another one. There are lots of them in the book, but I'm just picking a few of them. That says that the net present value of an investment will decline eventually as the fixed cost increases. And this, unfortunately, I hate to tell you, applies to investments in education. A master's degree tends to be a very profitable investment, but a PhD, as we all know, is substantially iffier. So just thinking about the amount of fixed costs you have to put in the rate of return.
Okay.
Uncertainty is a terrible business. And if the uncertainty associated with a project changes the actual realization of an investment, the results tend to be much more serious if you've made a big fixed cost investment in the first place. So looking at two investments with different levels of fixed cost and different levels of project duration, and equal expected uncertainty at the beginning, one can see that the one with the larger fixed cost and the longer duration has a higher net present value. But if conditions change and the uncertainty level goes up, the investment with the larger commitment suffers a larger loss. So one has to be aware that circumstances can take what appears to be ex ante a highly profitable enterprise and turn it into one which is substantially riskier. That just flows out of the equation. And we argue that the equations also provide a simple mathematical exposition to Hyman Minsky's insight that stability is destabilizing. If you have low uncertainty, it fosters investment in high fixed cost projects, even where the discount rates are the same. But if the uncertainty level goes up, then, for example, a financial crisis, the enterprise with the project built with the expectation of low uncertainty, here we are, this project is going to suffer a much bigger loss. The project that was built with the expectation of a higher level of uncertainty. So the more confident you are, the bigger you are, the harder you fall. The more confident you are, the more likely you are to take risks, to build risks into your project that are going to destabilizing the realization of the product. And that's essentially Minsky's argument. Okay, nothing surprising really there. I mean, once you start thinking about it, you say this is all just pure common sense. And that's all I claim it to be. It's common sense, however, that is expressed here. And I think this is a contribution. It's expressed here in a mathematical form. I didn't make up those are not hand-drawn graphs. They flow out of the equation that we developed. And they're essentially applications of the entropy law. Let me just give you a quick interpretation of a major event coming up on the 100th anniversary of it, the Great Depression. And this is owing not to myself, but to a presentation that was made by a professor at the University of Victoria at the UT Energy Symposium last fall. The Great Crash of 1929 is still a disputed topic in the history of economics. Milton Friedman believed that it was essentially due to mismanagement by the Federal Reserve in an otherwise stable economic system. And that is a doctrine that Ben Bernanke and Christy Roemer also accepted. My father, John Maynard Keynes, tended to argue that there was a psychological instability in the system, that essentially speculative speculative mania, which eventually had to collapse. So this is, as far as I was aware, a new interpretation of what the precipitating factor behind the Great Depression, and it really is an example of what starts here changes the world. That is to say, the oil discoveries in Texas and Oklahoma, which occurred in the late months of 1929, led to a sharp collapse in the expected profitability of the railroads, which were the major industry in the United States in the 1920s, and carried almost all of its capital, a very large share of its capital equipment, a very large share of its energy demands, based on coal and steam. Here's what happened on the 22nd of October, 1929. Standard Oil, large California oil producer, cut its prices, and the other firms followed suit. Why? Because there was a clear expectation of a large glut in oil. 24th of October, 1929, Black Thursday. Prices of steel stocks crash in heavy liquidation, total drop of billions, 2,600,000 shares sold, $4 billion of value lost. 2 days. Here's another one. October 29th, 1929. Standard Oil cuts big crude storage. It cut its storage because the expectation that oil would need to be conserved had disappeared, and the price at which it could be sold was dropping like a stone. Okay. Reverses previous policy, reduction of 20 million barrels, about 22% in 2.5 years. Same day, October 29th, 1929, Black Tuesday, stock prices slumped by $14 billion. This was the worst day in the history. Coincidence or cause and effect? There is, I think, a very interesting case that what was going on here was precisely a change in the expected profitability of the entire industrial system based on a sudden realization that the energy basis of the system was going to change in a dramatic way. And the result of that was that the entire system went essentially belly up until 4 years later when the New Deal began to lay down the infrastructure for an oil and electricity-based economy. And what was that infrastructure? It was roads. It was airfields. It was hydroelectric power. It was the whole reconstruction, Tennessee Valley, ultimately nuclear power as well. I can tell you that my father emigrated to the United States from Canada in 1930, bought a Model T Ford with another student, drove out to Berkeley. Gasoline was 10 cents a gallon. And from Lincoln, Nebraska to the California line, there were no paved roads. That's what the New Deal did. 600,000 miles of paved roads, as well as many public facilities and monuments and many other things. What were those roads paved with? They were paved with oil. So as we think about structures and implications, we can think about what's happening now with energy transitions. There's perhaps a general expectation that this will be smooth. And if you come up with a low-cost alternative to the existing energy system, that you can sort of swing into it in a general upswing, but that wasn't the case in the Depression. In the Depression, it took 4 years and then a massive effort that took another 4 or 5 years to create the infrastructure for a changed energy environment. Other applications, I've already talked about briefly about sanctions and trade, technologies for energy production, and I think one can apply this to the problem of artificial intelligence and its use of power. And you can apply it to the stresses on household budgets and the effects on fertility rates. And all of those things fit rather nicely into the framework, the general framework that we're describing. So a range of problems which are not easy to deal with if you limit yourself to the conventional textbook interpretation are accessible here. Not a big surprise. Universal laws have many implications, and all we did, thanks to the insights of my co-author essentially, was to express this particular one in a way which makes its uptake into economic problems more easier for people who like to have mathematical expression of things to absorb. Thanks very much.
Thank you.